guys and ghouls.
Oh, I had to swallow. You're tuned in to Broadcast from the Belfry, a good, not great podcast for the morbidly curious.
My name is Sanjay, and the other voice you're hearing currently, it's mine, but like the other one, the one from before, was Georgia. How are you doing today, George?
Yeah, it thunderstormed and rained all day, and it was warm enough to have the windows open so I could just listen to it, and we watched The Office. Stu didn't go to work, and we watched The Office all day. It was a good day.
I literally just asked how you were doing, and you didn't answer. You said a lot of
other
things.
It was a good
things.
Day.
Oh, okay,
it was a good
cool.
day.
That's awesome. God. You could have said all of that and then be like, and I fucking hated it. And just like, wow, okay, that's so
yeah.
That's so rude. But
I mean, he does think that I hate it when he's home all day, so.
You do hate your boyfriend, so. If watching a lot of 50s TV has taught me anything, it's that you should hate your spouse / partner or whatever. So you're doing great. Ooh, nice eyebrows. A voice you haven't heard that also has nice eyebrows is Hope. How are you doing today, Hope?
I'm doing suspiciously well.
Mm-hmm. Suspiciously. Hope is a social media person and on the ones and twos. And fact checks, because I'm wrong a lot. Also, sorry if my voice is a little weird today, guys. I'm messing with some audio stuff, and I'm listening to my voice back half a second later. Terrifying. If you know how to fix that.
I'm just saying, you know there's trouble in the air when we're all having a good day.
I guess, yeah. I'm having an
That's
okay
what
day.
I'm saying. I got a new tattoo, I got a raise, I got my COVID vaccine, and Halsey acknowledged me publicly on Instagram and Twitter for my makeup, and I just feel like something terrible is going to go wrong any second.
That's fair.
I was trying to think of what it could be, like something that wouldn't be gross or actually scary, but like a big thing. I can't think of it. I thought about like ice cream disappearing, just like boom, gone, like blip style. And then all the ice cream comes back 5 years later. It's just twice as much ice cream as we can do anything with. So it's like a curse and then a blessing. So yeah, we're a podcast for the morbidly curious or something. And just so you guys know, I had tickets today to go to a tequila tasting. And I was going to do that. But then a bunch of other stuff happened. So we're recording now instead. So that was the thing I was going to do. There's a guy that lives in Manhattan who is like one of those dudes that literally travels for alcohol sales in the cool way. So he lived in Mexico for a while, like lived on a farm, like where the agave was raised. He like went to the place where it was processed, like turned into mezcal, turned into different tequila, did a bunch of stuff. And he's supposed to just be like a genius, like some kind of savant. So I was like, cool, I'll hang out with Adam. Nope. Yeah, apparently like not that many people in Manhattan wanted to go, but I think it's also just weird timing. So it actually is still happening. I just couldn't go because my friend that was supposed to take off work didn't, because she forgot. So thanks, Mallory, for having the smoothest brain around.
Hey, you all listeners should buy our stickers and also send us your listener stories. The end. Show's over.
What listener stories? What are you talking about?
I don't know. Ghost stories, Tony, or what else? Cryptid sightings, alien abductions, true crime encounters. Yeah,
so if you have any of those, please contact us at broadcastfromthebelfry@gmail.com, or you can send it to us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram by searching Broadcast from the Belfry. We can redact your name if you want, or we can make sure we say your name more. It depends what you want. But yeah, send us those stories. We have a couple. Thank you to those who have sent them in, and we're going to do a whole big thing about it. And by big thing, an episode. So we're really looking forward to it.
Yep.
What are we talking about today?
Hey, remember like before Christmas, we gave the listeners a choice?
No. Was it the choice to listen? And they did, and we are grateful.
Well, yeah, that. No, we gave them a choice between four true crime events, and we had a tie. So I rolled a d20, and the tie was between the Menendez brothers and the Lindbergh baby.
Wait,
and
this
so
is
I
pretty
said,
important. Did you, like, even saw high-low, or, like, how did you decide, like, which one when you rolled
a
d20?
I was literally just going to tell you until you interrupted me.
Good.
The tie was between the Menendez brothers and the Lindbergh baby, and so I picked odds for the Lindbergh baby, because there's only one baby, and one is an odd number, And then I picked even for the Menendez brothers because there's two of them and that's an even number. Ooh. And guess what I rolled? Actual number. Guess what number it was?
Nat 20.
No. A 7. So, what are we talking about?
We're talking about the baby.
So, buckle into your strollers. I think this is a pretty interesting historical true crime roller coaster.
Sweet. And it's also been enough time for me to forget whatever I knew before. So, I'm really excited. Let's do it.
Did you know anything before?
I think I asked you guys a question.
If you did, I don't remember for once.
Yeah, right? It's so fresh and new.
So, to start with, let's talk about who Charles Lindbergh was, other than the father of the baby, whose name was also Charles, you know, just to make things confusing. Papa Charles was an aviator, and he mostly worked doing stunts in biplanes. I really want to fly a biplane. I want my pilot's license so bad. Anyway. He became super famous when he successfully crossed the Atlantic alone. He wasn't the first person to cross it, which I think some people confuse him with, but he was just the first person to do it solo. So he was awake for like 55 hours and he suffered hallucinations associated with sleep deprivation. And I think he's kind of an amateur. You get hallucinations after 55 hours. I have gone longer without sleep and I didn't have hallucinations. Yeah, shout out to finals when you're an architect. Major architecture student. Also, he could have taken a power nap between his pre-flight prep and then the actual 33-hour flight. Silly.
Yeah, that would have made a lot of sense.
In December of 1927, he flew his plane, the Spirit of St. Louis, nonstop from D.C. to Mexico City, and while he was there, he met Anne Morrow, who was the daughter of the U.S. ambassador, and 2 months later... they got married.
That's actually kind of like Disney-esque. I like it. You know, it's like you're just a highfalutin airman. And on your first 33-hour flight, you meet the daughter of the ambassador. And then bing bang,
yeah, you have a kid. She became his co-pilot and radio operator. And then she was one of the first women to get a certain kind of pilot's license. And they did a bunch of groundbreaking flights together, like... going from the U.S. to China, and they were the first couple to fly from Africa to South America. What? Yeah.
I would like to say now that this is really wholesome to me, and I'm enjoying it, so I know it's gonna suck and get really gross.
Yeah, okay. On that note, he also coordinated funding for basically rocket fuel research for space travel, and he helped with developing a method for keeping organs alive outside of a body, because I think it was his sister who had, like, a heart condition. And that's all pretty cool, but by the time World War II rolled around, he was super fascinated with German air tech and was really opposed to the U.S. joining the war to the point where he would make public speeches criticizing both FDR and Jewish-run newspapers, so people started thinking of him as a traitor and anti-Semitic. And he tried to win a military commission after Pearl Harbor was bombed, but FDR barred him from service because of the things he said.
Whoa.
And he was also into eugenics, so...
yeah, this guy sounds real Nazi-y.
Yeah, he was really cool until...
he was a Nazi.
But then, in the 60s, he became really into conservation. He supported the World Wildlife Fund. He fought for endangered species and lobbied for environmental causes. So, it's okay if you feel confused about him. You're only gonna get more confused.
Okay.
Baby Charles, we'll call him Charlie from here on out, was born in 1930, and he was the apple of America's eye. That's all you need to know. We're gonna go through a timeline of events now, so buckle up.
Okay.
Charlie was kidnapped around 9 p.m. on March 1st, 1932, when he was 20 months old, and he was taken from the second floor of the family's home in Hopewell, New Jersey. What? I forgot how to read for a minute. He's noticed to be missing about an hour later by his nurse, Betty, who reported it's Charles and Anna, who were also awake, but no one heard anything, so... they conducted a search of the premises, and they found a homemade ladder that was used to access the nursery window, as well as some muddy footprints that weren't really clear enough to be useful, and also a ransom note demanding $50,000. And I'm gonna tell you what that note said. Dear sir, exclamation point, have $50,000 ready, R-E-D-Y, $25,000 in $20 bills, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you were to deliver the money, no E. We warn you for making any ding public or for notify the police. The child is in good, G-U-D, care. Indication for all letters are signature and three holes. Signature spelled signature and holes spelled H-O-H-L-S. And so there's this crazy complicated signature at the bottom. It's like picture a Venn diagram of two blue circles with a big red circle in the overlapping part. And then there's a hole punched through that circle and a hole punched on either side of the blue circles.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's like the signature of the kidnappers. The handwriting is very poor, and investigators believe it was written by someone whose native language is German for a few different reasons. One being the Dear Sir exclamation point, because that's how a German would write that. Like over here, we would write Dear Sir comma, but in German, it's Dear Sir exclamation point.
Mm-hmm.
Such a dramatic language. And also the dollar signs are put after the amounts. So like $50,000 and the dollar being on the right side instead of on the left, like we would put it over here. Stuff like that. And the spelling errors. And so the note is given to the New Jersey State Police. No blood was found anywhere and no fingerprints were found. The family offered a $50,000 reward to anyone with information. And this was during the Depression, so let's remember that $50,000 was over $1 million in today's money.
Dude, basically, I would have just given someone my kid for that much. And they were like, hey, our 20-month-old is gone. There's no blood here. And I'm like, wow.
Oh, I got one. You want it?
He's brown now. And, you know, that's you're still racist. So, yeah, here, brown people don't have blood. Here's your kid. $1 million, please. You can call him whatever you want. Boy. You can call him Charles or Charlie or whatever. Yeah.
Investigators also believe that the kidnappers were informed by someone close to the family because the family was still in the process of building their Hopewell home, so they weren't staying there full time. And their weekdays they typically spent at Anne's parents' estate in Englewood. So on this particular evening, they decided to stay at the Hopewell house because Charlie had a cold and Anne wanted to let him rest instead of moving him, you know, traveling. This was the first time they'd ever spent a Tuesday on the property. So it was completely unusual, not part of their normal routine. How would the kidnappers have known without inside information that this was happening? Tons of people were volunteering to help search. They were putting up reward money for information. Even Al Capone got involved. He was waiting to be transferred to prison after his tax evasion arrest, and he said, I know how Mrs. Capone and I would feel if our son was kidnapped, which was pretty rich coming from, like, fucking Scarface, but,
yeah,
you know, whatever.
And someone that doesn't pay taxes, so, like, twice as bad, honestly. Like, you murdered
how many sons has he kidnapped and murdered?
Yeah, exactly.
So he put up a $10,000 reward for any information that would lead to an arrest, and he even tried to make a deal offering his connections to help find the kidnappers in exchange for his release. But Lindbergh declined his offer. Here's my question. Would you accept the help of a super well-known mob boss for something like this, knowing what kind of debt they'd be able to hold over your head in the future?
Easy. I don't care. And the guy's a Nazi, too. I don't know. Like, once again, I just don't think that Nazis care about the future that much. Like, if you told a Nazi, like, hey, like, I'm doing a survey, how long do you think you're gonna live? And they'll be like, oh, until the end of time. Like, oh, and when's that? You're just like, I don't know, like, 2050? Like, no. Well, yes, because of global warming. But, like, Nazis don't acknowledge global warming either. He probably would have been like, yeah, I'll just have my aeroplanes, like, fly into you later, Al Capone. Come at me. Yeah, I would definitely, if I was a rich inventor pilot Nazi, totally would take Al Capone's out.
I just started picturing you as Samuel L. Jackson in the first Kingsman movie, because he's not a Nazi, but he sure shit gives a damn about global warming, and he tries to murder everyone to fix it, so.
Yeah, I mean, I would think of me more as, like, literally can't think of anybody except for, no, that scene in the Chappelle Show skit where he's a Klansman and doesn't know he's black because he's blind. It'd be like that.
Okay.
But also, I'm a pilot, so I can't be blind, and I'm an inventor. You can be blind and an inventor, but you can't be blind and a pilot yet.
By March 6th, a second note was received upping the ransom to $70,000. So the governor calls a conference with the police procedures and any theories. You know, they go over all that stuff. And this is when Lindbergh's lawyer brought on some private investigators. I keep having to burp. Hold on.
So the thing about private investigators is it means that there's public investigators. So private investigators only investigate private manners or like matters and secretly. Public investigators just shout obvious facts outside. That's it.
Public investigators are Detective Jake Peralta. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. What was that?
A real fast motorcycle. Wow. Oh. They woke up my kitten. Eat shit. But yeah, no, like Jake Peralta, but same talent. Less qualified.
Okay. So people like me and Hope, who watch a lot of true crime stuff, and then we just like put the details together.
Yeah.
We don't have detective qualifications, but we can put a picture board together and connect everything with Red String.
Exactly. You can Pepe Sylvia whatever you want. Yeah.
Okay.
Also, cool. Thank you, Hope, for sending a picture of the ransom note. I'm looking at it right now.
It'll also be posted, of course. And I also just wanted to chime in and say, Georgia, don't act like we are not more qualified than most detectives.
Yeah, reading some of these botched jobs. Oh, hi, Kiki. Come here. Luna's here. Everything's fine. There were third and fourth notes going back and forth about setting up someone to act as a go-between, and it was settled that this go-between would be Dr. John Condon, who was a retired school teacher living in the Bronx, and he also offered to contribute an extra $1,000 to the ransom payment. I'm going to call him Good Guy John, I guess.
Like, ironically?
For clarification purposes. We'll come back to that. He uses the code name Jaffsy in the newspaper columns to communicate with the kidnapper. This is like a code name that they've set up between themselves. And Lindbergh gave him the cash payment for the ransom. And also the second and third notes were mailed and the postmark was from Brooklyn. So that was on March 10th, 1932. On March 12th, Dr. Condon received an anonymous telephone call around 8:30 at night, and then a fifth ransom note was delivered to him by a cab driver named Joseph Perrone, who said that he'd gotten it from an unidentified stranger, and this fifth note led him to a sixth one beneath a stone near a subway station, and the sixth note included instructions for the doctor to meet a guy using the name John at Woodlawn Cemetery. So we have Dr. John and then this other John.
Okay, tracking, I think.
Yeah, so Good Guy John follows the instructions and meets fake name John, and they discuss payment and proof that this guy actually has the baby. Everything is agreed upon. There's a little more communication via the newspaper, basically stating that they're willing to pay the ransom. And Good Guy John describes fake name John as having a heavy German accent. He refers to him as Cemetery John. And he says he's about 5'7", with a tall forehead and a large fleshy mass on his left thumb. Gross. On March 16th, the doctor receives a baby's sleeping suit. I guess that's like a onesie for old-timey rich people. I don't really know.
No.
Maybe it's like a tuxedo shirt.
So it's like a three-piece with a cummerbund, so technically a four-piece suit, but for an infant. So, you know, a very large cat or a very small, like, dog could probably wear it.
Oh, yeah. Luna could totally wear it. She's the same size as a 20-month-old baby.
I think your cats are supposed to wear, like, size 3T clothing, like, on average. No. I don't remember for sure, though.
I mean, she still has her onesies. I could look what size I had to get her. Mm-hmm. With the sleeping suit comes a seventh note. The suit is given to Charles and it's identified as Charlie's. And then on March 21st, an eighth note is received. This one talks about how the kidnapping had been planned for a year and that complete compliance was necessary. Moving along to March 29th now. So it's been, what, how many days? oh, March 1st to March 29th. It's been a long time, almost a month. The family nurse, Betty, the one who found him missing, finds a thumb guard that Charlie would have been wearing when he was kidnapped, and it was near the entrance to the estate. And then the next day, a ninth note was given to Condon without any codes for use in the newspaper, any, you know, like, secret communication methods. And it threatened to increase the ransom to $1,000. And then, on April 1st, he got a 10th note telling him to have the money ready the following night, and the doctor, as usual, replied by an ad in the paper. He received the 11th note the next night, again delivered by a cab driver, a different one, though this note, too, would come from an unknown man. The doctor was led to a 12th note under a stone again near an address that was included in the note, and this one gave more instructions to meet a fake named John again that evening. I guess I agreed to settle for the original ransom amount because, from what I read, they only gave him $50,000, I guess. So, good guy John hands that over, and fake name John gives him a 13th note, takes the money, and takes off in the northern direction towards the woods.
Does the note say, eat shit, nerd?
I mean, it pretty much does, yeah. It's worth mentioning that the ransom was delivered in a custom-made wooden box so that it could be identified later. And the ransom also included gold certificates, which were about to be taken out of circulation, so it would draw more attention if anyone tried to use them. And the bills weren't marked, but they had recorded all of the serial numbers of the bills that were included in the ransom payment.
Smart.
So this 13th note, it's the final one they get, and it states that Charlie could be found on a boat called Nelly near Martha's Vineyard. And they go there, they search all the ports twice, but they didn't find a boat with that name, nor did they find baby Charlie. Fast forward to May 12th, so like another 2 months later, a guy named William Allen is an assistant on a delivery truck, and he hopped off to go pee on a tree, and that's when he noticed something. Charlie was partially buried, badly decomposed, and the coroner reported that his skull was badly fractured and that he had been dead for about 2 months from a blow to the head. What? And the family nurse, Betty, identified him from his overlapping toes and the shirt he was wearing that she had made for him. And it's assumed that he died the same night he was taken.
So what was the proof, like, since that had to be established earlier?
It was that onesie, the sleeping suit. It wasn't proof of life. It was proof that, oh, they had the baby. Yeah.
Okay, dude, that sucks.
So like I said earlier, investigators began thinking that he had to have been taken by someone known to the family. Even good guy John, the doctor, had been suspected, but there was no evidence found. And Charles stood by him throughout the investigation. And even after the body was found, good guy John was still involved unofficially. He spent his time trying to figure out who Cemetery John was. But he gets a little suspicious because at some point he agreed to, it's not even suspicious, it's just like poor taste, because he agrees to appear in a vaudeville act based on the kidnapping, which is just in the props.
Yeah.
And it's also been said that he's been known to embellish and be a little on the flamboyant, dramatic side. So it's hard to know what parts of his statements were accurate. I think he was just like a fanboy of Lindbergh and kind of wanted to be noticed by him, and like jumping in and trying to help with the investigation was the best way he could think to do that, even if it did leave him being a little classless at some points. It's also worth noting that on June 10th, an employee of the Morrow's Englewood estate, Violet Sharp, was about to be questioned for like the fourth time, and she went up to her room and drank silver polish, killing herself in a pretty rough way. This made everyone wonder why she would have done such a thing. It made the police look really bad, maybe for being too harsh with her. She was cleared of any involvement. She had alibis that checked out. But it's theorized that what had happened was that the kidnappers called the Morrow estate to make sure that the Lindberghs were there. And not knowing who she was talking to, Violet told them that they were staying at the other house. And then the fact that she gave them the information that led to Charlie's death left her with just massive amounts of guilt, and that's why she killed herself.
That is
especially with like the police giving her like super intense questioning all the time and her not being able to like move past it.
I mean, yeah, so she probably was like already bearing that guilt because she's just like, oh yeah, I'm doing my job, it's all good, whatever. No one wants this place, it doesn't matter. And then
So suspects weren't really getting the investigators anywhere, so they focused on the money. They created a pamphlet listing the serial numbers of each bill and distributed them throughout businesses, mostly in New York City. So the next year, in 1933, some of the gold certificates were brought to a bank to be exchanged, and the bank realized they were from the ransom, but seemed like the guy used a fake name, so that didn't really get them anywhere. But over a couple years, detectives noticed that a lot of the ransom bills were being spent along the Lexington Avenue subway route, which went from the Bronx to the east side of Manhattan. And it happens to include Yorkville, which was a German-Austrian neighborhood. So in 1934, a bank teller came across one of the gold certificates, sees that it had a license plate number penciled in the margin, so they trace it to a gas station where the manager explains that he took note of the license plate because the guy was acting suspicious and he thought it might have been a counterfeiter. Ooh. And so the plate gets traced to a German guy named Richard Hauptmann, who did have a criminal record in Germany for using a ladder to climb into the second story window of the mayor's house to steal money and valuables, and for mugging two women walking with baby carriages.
Dude, you really need to switch up your MO. Like, literally, like, what's a Lindbergh baby case about? I don't know, dude. Baby ladder window.
Baby ladder.
Yeah, what the heck? This dude's done.
So, when he's arrested, he does have one of the gold certificates on him. And then later, $14,000 of the ransom money is found in his garage. Now, he says he didn't have any connection to the crime or any knowledge that the money was from a ransom and that it was left with him by his friend Isidore Fisch, who was also a German, who owed him money for a business deal, and Fisch returned to Germany and then died, leaving Hauptmann the money in a shoebox. And this story didn't go over too well. Hauptmann said he kept the box on a shelf in the broom closet in his kitchen, but his wife said that she hung her apron there every day and had never seen a box. And other people claim that Fish couldn't have had possession of any ransom money at all because he couldn't afford his rent in Germany or treatment for the TB that killed him. So Hauptmann's home is searched. They find several things: a notebook that contained a construction sketch of a ladder similar to the one used to access the nursery window.
It's a ladder, my guy. Like, how hard is it? You build one ladder, you know how to build ladders.
Condon's phone number and address written inside a closet on the wall, and a section of wood that was examined by an expert and determined to be an exact match of the wood used to build the ladder found at the scene. Also, 8 handwriting experts pointed out similarities between his handwriting and their ransom notes.
I really hope that when they said they, like, got an expert to inspect the wood, they just went to a dam and, like, started chittering, and then a beaver walked up and, like, nodded and was like, chitter, chitter. And they were like, thank you again, Detective Beaverson. And he, like, tips his little beaver hat and just, like, swims away. They give him a fish, and he, like, they throw it in there, and he, like, catches it in his tiny hands.
He has, like, a little thumbs up with his beaver paw.
Yeah. Or little tails up, or big old tails up. No, he gives a thumbs up, and then he gives a dun-dun with his tail against the Damies building.
Long story short, Hauptmann received the death sentence, but after some secret visits, the New Jersey governor cited evidence that the kidnapping couldn't have been a one-person job. That sucks for him. He was still electrocuted in 1936. His wife sued the state twice for unjust execution and fought to clear his name until she died at the age of 95 in 1994. She basically spent her whole life trying to prove that he was innocent, even though she was like, nah, I've never seen that box where he said it was, which I think is kind of funny, but
yeah, well, I mean, she's probably just like, he's not a criminal, he's just stupid. Like, there's a difference.
I would say
there.
The same. Yeah, I would say something like that. Okay, that's the official story. Do you want to do your segment, and then we can jump into some alternate theories and everything else?
Yeah, dude. Let's do a little bit of Sanjay shorts, you know? We're talking about my khakis. All right, cool. So we're gonna do a little bit of the Sanjay shorts time. This thing that I care about is inspired by a fan favorite listener to the show, Cindy. Thank you, Cindy, for the inspo for this unknowingly. Today, we're talking about pasta. Everybody loves it. We got pasta. So we're gonna I have three different things that I'm gonna say. It'll just be two truths and a lie style. Two of them will be true. One of them will not be true. Georgia will give her first estimate. I'll talk a little bit, and she'll do it again, and we'll see what's up. Maybe someone's gonna learn something that doesn't make me sad. So, all right, starting off, according to a survey, the number one kind of pasta consumed in America is spaghetti.
Okay.
Pasta was first brought to the United States by Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
And pasta was first eaten in Spain, not Italy.
Ooh. I'm going with the last one for now.
Last one? All right, cool.
Yeah.
All right. So there are over 600 varieties of pasta that are consumed on a daily basis. In the United States, there are three that stand above all, and one of them, surprisingly, is not elbow.
Oh,
Going
that
to
is
number
funny.
two, Thomas Jefferson, former president, is claimed with bringing pasta to America. Back in 1789, yeah, I can read. Back in 1789, he went on a trip, brought it back, and it's been a staple ever since. Although their neighbors are more widely known for I'm looking at a beer right now. I'm dumb. Although their neighbors are more widely known for eating pasta, pasta actually originated in Spain due to the different climate. It's a little bit more conductive. So, what are you thinking?
Because I guess that could refer historically going way back before pasta was really pasta and like that kind of. I don't know. I'm also second guessing that mac and cheese is technically pasta. And America eats a lot of mac and cheese. But also, I know how often you eat spaghetti, and I know I have two types of spaghetti in my refrigerator right now. I don't know. The last one was weirdly way easier than this one. Which is dumb because the last one was just like shit that you kind of made up. So, I know your brain better than I know pasta. I
Both of them
guess.
covered in sauce all the time.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick with my original guess. Spain.
Final answer.
Yeah, this is gonna be wrong.
Georgia, you
I
are
almost got
two
right
for
one.
two.
Yes!
So, yeah, Thomas Jefferson did bring pasta to the United States in 1789. It was not on record before then. So, although it might have been eaten or something similar might have been eaten in, like before then, he was the first person to bring what we know as the past.
I think he also just had a like a thing for Italy because like his house was called Monticello, so
I
that's
didn't know that.
Italian sounding.
We're all learning
Yeah, one of
things.
my archaeology professors did some work there and they found his like hemorrhoid like a hemorrhoid device thing.
So
Good stuff.
America's top three most consumed pastas, according to a survey, aren't spaghetti, penne, and rotini.
I think I
Surprisingly,
have
elbow.
all three of those types of pasta in my cabinet.
I have two of them. I don't have that much penne. But yeah, Americans do eat a ridiculous amount of macaroni, which is a pasta. But nope, it is not in the top three, surprisingly.
Interesting.
And okay, so I guess let's have a bonus round. So if
Okay.
pasta was not originally from Spain, where is it from?
So it's not Italy. Is that what
I
you're
mean, it
telling
could
me?
be.
Now that sounds like a trick question. It has to be somewhere in the Mediterranean. I'm just gonna stare at you until you talk.
Was the answer just the Mediterranean?
Yep.
Okay, no, pasta was first eaten in China
Oh, I
as
guess that
early as
makes sense.
5000 BC.
I mean, noodles are noodles, man. It doesn't matter if you call them noodles or pasta. Same thing.
It's actually specifically that, yeah, Marco Polo introduced noodles to Italy in the 12th century, but that, yeah, like loosely, like pasta is pasta, I guess noodles are noodles, but
Yeah.
like after Marco Polo took it back home, Italy was like, yo, let's make an empire.
Like, were they rice noodles in China and then he brought them back to Italy, and they were like, well, we don't grow rice, but we grow wheat, so I bet we can do something similar?
Yep.
Okay.
Pretty much. So it was like, hey, you know what looks a lot like rice? Wheat, technically. You know, like rice kernels, wheat kernel. And they're all oblong. They're footballed.
They're all grains.
They're all grains. And that's what I've got today. I've been thinking a lot about pasta, so it's like, let's see how much Georgia knows. And apparently, not that much about pasta, but a lot about Italy.
I was like, man, if Sandra comes to visit, what kind of food am I going to make? And then I was like, pasta, you idiot. Shut up.
Just pasta. Moving that's all on. I need.
Like, just make a giant pot of spaghetti, and that's literally the only food that's in the house.
You can literally put a twin-size air mattress on the floor with a pot of pasta next to it, and I would stay there for, like, 2 nights at the least. Yeah, like, that sounds great. Oh,
2 nights, okay.
Also, I'm 6'2", for everyone listening who doesn't know how tall I am. I cannot fit on a twin-size mattress. Yeah. I also can't listen to the song Twin-Size Mattress, so.
Cool, all right. 2 for 2, I'm winning!
Yeah, it's unfortunate for me. I'll keep ramping up the intensity until you lose, and then I'll go back down from there.
It's good for my ego when you let me win. We got 10 out of 12 questions on Jeopardy today on the Google. It was great.
Nice.
Yeah.
I think the last few times I've done Jeopardy, I've done awful. Like, real, real bad.
The Google Jeopardy, it keeps track of things for you, and so every once in a while it'll be like, oh, you've answered your 700th question correctly, and stuff like that. Makes me feel good.
Wait, what is Today Google it told Jeopardy?
Us, you just say, hey, Google, let's play Jeopardy. And then it gives you, there's basically extra questions from each of the categories that were on Jeopardy today.
Dude, that's actually and then pretty
you can,
crazy.
Yeah, and then you can pay, it's like $2 a month, and that's J+. So then you also get to play Double Jeopardy. So that's what we do. And then there's like Teen Jeopardy on Saturdays and Sports Jeopardy on Sundays.
That sounds like a really boring day.
Sports Jeopardy is it's not too great because Stu only knows stuff about like Chiefs football, and I don't. I know like some random hockey facts, and that's about it. Although we did get a lot of questions about tennis right this week, so but yeah, that's what we do every night. We play Jeopardy with the Google.
So old.
I know, it's adorable. Thanks.
Okay. Now back to our regular scheduled programming. Oh yeah, let's add some conspiracies.
Yeah, there are a lot of statements about Hauptmann's guilt, and some people think that he was guilty, but don't think that he should have been executed. Other people think he wasn't guilty, that there was inadequate police work, shoddy police work. Nobody who ever watches true crime ever thinks that the police didn't do a good enough job investigating. That never happens.
They always do good every time. 10 out of 10.
Some people think that his counsel was ineffective, or that Lindbergh himself interfered with the investigation, or that the evidence against Hauptmann was circumstantial, that the witnesses were weak. Like, you get the idea. It was really highly criticized. For example, one author found that a fingerprint expert used a rare at the time method, which is the silver nitrate process, on the ladder and didn't find Hauptmann's fingerprints anywhere, even in places that someone who was constructing the ladder would have had to have touched. Like, if the ladder was being constructed and these two pieces of wood are joining, there was no fingerprints on the pieces of wood where they joined, where you wouldn't have been able to clean them off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. So even if you, like, built it, wiped it down, and then wore gloves when you were doing the thieving, the baby thieving, then there would still be your fingerprints around, like, in
Yeah,
the,
like,
the
if
joints.
You took the ladder apart to access.
What's the name of that? Like, the part where, like, two wood things combine. Is it, like, a joist?
A joint?
No, like, there's another word. There's a specific
word. It's
called
a joint.
No,
it's
there's, a like, joint. A specific word, I think.
It's a joint.
It's not a joint. Hope.
In woodworking, it's called a joint.
No, I think there's another name for, like, maybe it's when, like, the, like, peg end of a ladder, or a ladder rung, goes into the, like, side leg part.
I am not for sure, but I think joist is correct.
Yeah, eat my ass, Georgia.
But I'm not for sure. I don't know enough about wood and building things to know what part you're talking about, but a joist is a thing.
wood, you know, wood stuff. Come here. I've only heard the term joists used in terms of like floor, like construction, floorboards, joists, and ceiling joists.
It's a supporting part of a structure, is what Google says.
It is on the record that Georgia has been told to eat mine ass.
Where two correct. Pieces of wood come together, what is that called? A
mortar tendon joint?
Oh, a mortar tendon joint.
Yeah, that actually might have been it. Never mind. I think I combined two things.
It's an actual corner.
Okay, but like, if this is the edge of a ladder and this is the rung of a ladder, what would you call where those two pieces come together? Would you also call that a joint? That just be a rot. Okay, whatever. Bye.
This might be one of the rare times where everybody's right, which would be pretty fun. Thank you for listening to Broadcast from the Friend Free. We're all right.
Anyway, you get the idea.
Thank you, Hope.
So officials refused to take that finding into consideration, and then they just had the ladder washed, which shouldn't happen to evidence regardless.
Did it stink?
It's evidence. It doesn't matter if it stinks. It's evidence.
It kind of matters. You can't just put it in a bag. It's a ladder. It's big.
That is... And you could put it in, several bags. Like I did with my Christmas tree, I put the bottom in one, and then I put another trash bag over the top, and then I wrapped it up with tape.
Georgia, this was on a second story. Are you saying that you have two story-sized trash bags that you could put together?
They could have used tarps.
Tarps don't steal stink. Don't seal stink.
If you wrap... Okay, this is redundant. Okay. Some people think that Charles Lindbergh himself had something to do with the death of his son. Some people propose it was a prank gone wrong and that he climbed up the ladder, brought baby Charles out of the window, and then accidentally dropped him, so he hid the body in the woods and covered it up. This sounds a little silly.
Yes, that's too fanciful.
Yeah, most of that theory is based upon the fact that he was extremely controlling of the investigation, that he seemed to steer police, that he kept the contents of the ransom notes pretty secret. But I feel like a lot of that could be explained by the fact that, well, his child was kidnapped, so you would want, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for Charles, but I can speak for myself. And I would want, I'm a very controlling person, and I would be like, no, you're not doing enough, or you're not doing it right, you're not being thorough enough, or, you know, whatever. And also, logically, the less people who know it's in the ransom notes, the easier it could be to trip someone up in an interrogation. Police often retain aspects of crime so that if someone knows a detail that hasn't been released, then that gives them a pretty solid lead, right? On the other hand, let's remember that Charles was really into eugenics, which values genetic superiority, right? So some people think that Charles was embarrassed by Charlie's physical disabilities and arranged the kidnapping to secretly have him moved to an institution, which is pretty common at the time, especially for rich people, you know, who were embarrassed with their kids or they weren't good enough, so they shipped him off to an institution to grow up and become a nun or something. We all watch Riverdale. We know what happened when she got pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember her name. What's her name? P?
It's Betty's sister.
Polly.
Yeah. So, rumor has it that Charlie's soft spot hadn't closed up, which can be indicative of other conditions like hypothyroidism, Down syndrome, which a eugenicist would have really had issues with, and also rickets, which he was supposed to have been diagnosed with a mild form of rickets. And remember, Charlie was 20 months old, and the fontanelle usually closes up, that's the soft spot, usually closes up in the first couple of months. Or at least the main part of it closes up after a couple of months, and then the rest of it closes up at around 2 years old, 2.5 years. And he still didn't have as much closure, as much fusion of his skull bones as he should have had at his age. And then I mentioned the overlapping toes on his right foot that were used to identify his body. So that would have made it difficult for him to like learn how to stand up and walk and stuff. Things that someone with the values of Charles would have been less than displeased with, but still these people don't think that he intended for him to die. They just wanted to like have him snuck out and raised elsewhere. But the most believed alternate theory that's even being looked into by John Douglas, who is the real-life Holden Ford. Mindhunter.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So that, like, the guy that Holden Ford is the fictional version of. And then also the guy that Rossi and Gideon are both based off of in Criminal Minds. So the OG FBI profiler, he has a lot to say about this. First of all, he doesn't think that Charles fits the profile. He thinks that he was too controlling to have left such a task up to a group of outsiders, right?
Mm-hmm.
He also believes that it was never the kidnapper's intent to return Charlie alive because of how much effort and preparation you'd have to put into taking care of a baby, even for like a couple days. They said 2 to 4 days in the ransom note, they would have had to get like diapers and formula and someone to watch him all the time and food, you know, whatever. He does believe that Hauptmann was guilty, but he doesn't think he acted alone for several reasons, starting with the fact that all the money found at Hauptmann's house turned out to be just about 1/3 of the total ransom, and there's no evidence that he could have had the rest of it and spent it all since. You know, like, there was no money to follow, there were no expensive, luxurious items or, like, tickets or, you know, anything like that. So, logically, there would have to have been two other people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then Douglas also talks about many similar cases that he's seen throughout his career, and he says that there typically needs to be at least one other person to do something of this nature so that they can hype each other up just to, like, carry out the plan, and that this particular crime would have been too risky to do alone. Like, just the fact that there would have been another person needed to hold the ladder steady while you're, like, hurrying up it, stealing a baby, and then hurrying back down, you know? And then the main thing that he's been looking into, a guy named Robert Zorn reached out to John Douglas and told him that his dad, Gene, read an article about the kidnapping sometime in the 60s while he was at a barber shop, and this triggered a memory from when he was a teenager. Turns out, back in the 30s when the kidnap took place, Gene was a teenager living in a German neighborhood in the South Bronx, and he had a neighbor named John Knoll. John Knoll was a German immigrant who kind of befriended Gene and encouraged him to take up stamp collecting.
Nerds.
One day, John invited Gene to go along to the fair with him, and while they're there, they meet up with John's younger brother Walter and a third German guy they called Bruno. And Gene's hanging out while they're talking, but he says he remembers them talking about a place called Englewood, which is where the Morrow estate is, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't think much of it at the time until he read this article about the kidnapping, which outlined Hauptmann's arrest, but states that he probably didn't work alone and that someone known only as Cemetery John was involved. And Gene remembered that around the time of the kidnapping, John started giving him really valuable stamps to add to his collection. And then, right before Hauptmann's trial, John and his wife get themselves first-class tickets and sail round trip to Hamburg. Each ticket was worth about 60 years of their rent, just to put things into perspective.
Holy shit.
So that happens just before Hauptmann goes to trial. And then they return to the U.S. the day after Hauptmann is sentenced. Well, Gene dies, but his son Robert continues digging along this line of inquiry, and he finds out that Hauptmann's real name, his full name, is Bruno Richard Hauptmann, which wasn't really known by anyone because he used Richard for everything. And he also finds a picture of John Knoll, who looks like he's about 5'7", with a tall forehead and a large anomalous growth on his left thumb, and that he looks really similar to the police sketch.
What the fuck?
There's a little bit of doubt about this theory, mostly because Hauptmann had been going by Richard since he was a child, and that no one ever called him Bruno, so why would these guys, unless he was using it as some kind of alias, which would make it kind of a dumb alias, unless that's what he would want you to think.
I mean, there is some truth to that. Like, that kind of makes sense. So, yeah, like, that way, if he was just, like, in the neighborhood or whatever, people would be like, Bruno? Like, oh yeah, Richard. Like, oh yeah, like, forgot that's not his first name. Like, eventually yeah. everyone finds out if you don't go by your first name, you know? Yeah. And it's kind of just in the back of your head. So I wonder if that was just to, like, keep suspicion at bay.
And the other thing is that John is a really common name, which, mm-hmm. yeah, but how many Johns were connected to this case, too?
Literally. So. Yeah. Wait, so what happened with the money, though, at that point? Was he using it to, or, like, at these stamp things to buy stamps to kind of, like, launder it?
I don't think so. I think he was just spending money because he had it to spend.
No, but, like, excuse me, when the first dude was using his money, like, it got tracked, you know? And they knew exactly, like, the direct area that it was being used in, and, like, that's how they eventually found him.
I mean, I didn't really come across any information about his money being tracked, but I would assume that you would probably buy valuable stamps from another person directly, and that person probably wouldn't have, like, a pamphlet of the serial numbers and stuff, because those were distributed to actual businesses in the city.
So...
And then they left, right? So...
Okay, so that's something that, like, also might have just not been touched on in your research, I assume, but, like, that there might have been two hotspots, or it's along the trainway.
Yeah, they could have just not been looking in the area where he was spending it, too.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah. Okay, cool. That's, I mean, because that's what I would do, too. Like, I think Hope and I have talked about this, but if you wanted to launder money, like, Ozarks has taught me that it's super easy, you know, and, like, Breaking Bad, like, too easy. Just launder money if you want to.
Ozarks and Good Girls have me very convinced that I can very easily launder money and meet a really hot gang leader who may or may not try to kill me, but will have a neck tattoo.
Yeah, so they're like...
You heard it here first.
You know, and like, when I've thought about it in the past, because obviously, like, you think about stuff like this, like... My main hobby is playing Magic. Like, you can just buy Magic cards from dudes, like, Magic the Gathering cards, and, like, if you're buying collections, which happens in bigger cities a lot of the time, you can just offer cash. Like, people prefer cash. So, if you're traveling to do that or whatever, like, traveling for stamps, or I don't know how the stamp community goes, someone probably would say, like, oh yeah, no checks. Like, just cash, and, like, that way it's off the books and everything, which is better for everyone involved. So they probably did just, like, turn cash into stamps, and then, like, stamps into other cash. And it's a little bit weird to me that when they bought the tickets, that didn't flag anything, but...
Yeah, but, I mean, again, they probably... Maybe it was,
like, a German, like...
Because they were monitoring mostly the money in the city, like, in New York City. Mm-hmm. So if he went off to, like, one of the harbors or something to spend it to buy boat tickets, then maybe that was kind of outside their perimeter. I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
New York's like an island, so I don't really know. But a lot of the activity seemed to be around, like, Manhattan and Brooklyn and the Bronx. So I don't really know where he buy boat tickets in relation to those places, but...
Yeah, I assume you're right. It would be at a harbor. And on top of that, it could have been that they bought them from a German person. Like, a person that lives in Germany. Everyone knows that they come by every, like, week or so. And just, like, does trips, like, luxury or business, doesn't matter. And you can be like, hey, here's a bunch of U.S. money. Take it. And then when you actually got to Germany, they probably could just, like, get it transferred at the embassy or whatever. So, and that's... Yeah. Literal perfect laundering.
Yeah, I don't know. Sense. Nothing really came up about Walter either. They presume that he would have been the third guy, but in most of the, like, general research of this case, you only ever really hear about this last little bit about John Knoll, and then all about Houtman, obviously, because he was executed for it.
That's Are there any descendants or anything that have, like, continued research or anything like that?
Like, of Houtman?
Of, like, the three bad dudes.
Not that I have heard of. Maybe, I don't know. But not that I've heard of. And I don't remember, especially if they were pretty young, and his wife spent her entire life fighting to clear his name. But there was never any mention of any kids there, so.
So what happened to the money? Yeah. Does it just, like, go back to the, like, original source?
I assume that they would have taken it as evidence. Like, Houtman's money, I assume they would have taken for evidence.
All right, do we have any other information about the... Oh, no, I didn't ask this in the beginning. Why the fuck is this baby famous? Is it just because his parents were, like, real cool people?
Well, his dad was, like, the most famous guy in the country at the time, so...
Okay, so he was just, like, the blue ivy of the 1920s.
He was probably, like, Prince George of the 1930s, yeah.
I don't know who you just said, but I do know who Jay-Z and Beyonce's baby was, so. Or is. She's still alive.
Okay. Unlike basically, the Lindbergh baby. Like I said, Charles Lindbergh was, like, the most famous dude in America at the time for all of his aviation feats.
And
it's also the Depression, so people aren't doing things that involve money because the economy's terrible.
So they're keeping up with the Kardashians instead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not really that much different between then and now, in my opinion, but
Roaring 20s, depression. Yeah. What else? There's one more thing.
Pandemics.
Yeah, that's it, actually. Yeah, disease. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. He would be some big celebrity. Yeah.
Name one.
I can't think of a good comparison. Like, he's not famous for being a musician or an actor or something, which, I mean, actors were kind of famous then. Yeah, but he still, like, contributed to science and...
The dad contributed to the OJ trial.
Do you know his name?
Yeah, obviously everyone knows his name.
What's the dad's name?
I don't like that we're changing the topic right now. It's, okay, so, Chris...
Nope.
Wait, no. Chris is the mom. Like,
yeah.
Okay, so Jenner is the not the maiden name. So, like, there was... yeah, I don't know. I give up.
It's Robert.
Robert what? Oh, Robert Kardashian.
Kardashian! God. Oh my god.
Yeah, yep. Pooped my pants. Was thinking too hard. Flew too close to the sun. Oh, wait. This is actually the end, right?
Yep, I don't have any more notes.
No, I can ask questions now. This is my time. Okay,
cool. Then do it.
Heck yeah. If you were peeing on a tree in the woods, what scary thing would you not expect to find? That's, like, relevant to society. Like the Lindbergh case. Like, what would you, like, be scared to find while you're peeing in the woods?
I don't really pee in the woods. I have a big thing about that. So, it makes... archaeology field work really hard if there's no public restrooms nearby, but I try not to pee in the woods, so I would spend 8 hours in the field without going to the bathroom because I didn't want to pee in the woods.
It's not how this works. I need to know, well, what would you be scared to find in a, like, super, like, niche case where you have to pee in the woods, like you were in the woods, you've had 18 Diet Pepsis.
Do you know how women... The statistics of women being attacked by mountain lions are significantly higher because women go off alone to pee in the woods.
Wait, so you're peeing on a mountain lion? That's absurd.
No, I would not want to find a mountain lion if I was off in the woods peeing.
I guess that makes sense. Okay, cool. Hope, what would you not want to find? Or what would you be scared to find?
Anything, because if I'm peeing in the woods, I don't want anything near me.
No, I need something specific, you know.
Like, if it's a dead body, then that's not really affecting my peeing, I guess.
Well, no, you two would be excited.
Do anything. Like, it's dead, it's not gonna attack me or anything, so it can wait until I'm done peeing. Therefore, I don't think finding a dead body while you're peeing in the woods is that scary. It might take you back by surprise, but it's not scary.
Okay, here's the thing. First of all, I would like to also say I will not pee in the woods. Like, that will not ever happen. Also, I really don't go in the woods as a person. But also, as a woman, I wouldn't want to find a man while I was peeing in the woods. Because they'd just kill me.
Also that.
I think... I have, like, an image in my head of, like, so when, like, Charles was found, you know, someone's just, like, whistling, you know, weenie out, peeing on a tree, and just looking around, and then there's, like, baby arm, right?
Yep.
So what if, same situation, I'm in the woods, weenie out, I'm peeing, whistling, I look down, and I'm like, oh crap, it's a 1919, like, this S-class of submarine that disappeared from the middle of the Alps, and it definitely has live nuclear weapons, like, all of, like, super long name for a submarine that has live nukes that, like, disappeared somewhere, and I just, like, in peeing and see, like, the scope, and I brush dirt, and I'm just... submarine, like entirely on a submarine. That would scare me.
I would like to change my answer to lurking in the shadows.
Shia LaBeouf.
Actual cannibal Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah. No, that's a good one.
A little less funny now that we know he's a terrible person, but.
No, but imagine, like, you're in the woods, leaning against a tree for lumbar support.
Well, did I miss something, like, about Shia LaBeouf?
Yeah.
Oh, he's like. Hardcore woman abuser.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Sia, like, came out and confirmed a bunch of stuff that Shia's most recent ex was saying. And, yeah, I think he actually had to FaceTime or something.
I think he's in the process of it now. Mm-hmm. And he, like, admitted to it. He was like, oh, yeah, I'm garbage to women. But that's just who I am.
Then be something different.
Yeah, it was upsetting. Spaghetti, as it were.
No, yeah, you think about it. You're just in the woods, leaning against a tree, whistling, looking around. That's not a tree. That's a guy. That's television child actor Shia LaBeouf. Just painted, like, striped and brown, holding the branches like he's a tree.
Going back to a logical answer, I also would like to add, I would not like to come across an avalanche while I was trying to pee in the woods.
Once again, in my head, leaning against a tree, peeing, whistling, you know, having a good time, and you're like, my tummy's a little upset.
Oh my gosh.
Why is it so loud? I'm in the middle of an avalanche, and you were, like, peeing against a tree. Like, in the middle of an avalanche. Like, you were actively in a landslide. You didn't notice that you're moving at, like, 100 miles an hour down a mountain.
Can you imagine? You stroll into the woods. You're having a great day. You're minding your own business. And then, tractor beam. Ooh, and you're floating in the sky. And your pants are around your ankles. And you're all of a sudden, you are on board an alien ship. And it's really awkward.
How do you think pee works on a tractor beam?
It probably, like,
does it stay?
Floats around you. And
so, like, tractor beams kind of, like, negate gravity and then, like, pull you up, right? So there's, like, technically, like, the inverse gravity, but, like, kind of like when you're in space, technically, like, so you're peeing and there is an active force, like, down as the pee leaves your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So technically, would the pee get to whatever, like, maximum distance it could before it reaches that, like, inverse, like, of the gravity? And then it just stays there and then it starts moving up? So technically, from the moment you leave the ground, like, pee is impacting the ground, right? Mm-hmm. And then you start getting lifted. So, is there just, like, a stream of pee from your hoo-ha to the ground the entire time you're peeing in a tractor beam?
I think that it stops hitting the ground in relation to how far off the ground you are.
No, exactly. So, like, but, like, so the pee is still, like, in the ground, but the stream will, like, get... It'll go to a point.
The stream stops hitting the ground. Yeah. And then it's like...
But you're moving up as you're still, like, forcing down. So you just have, like, a mile-long pee stream connecting you to the ground.
I don't know about you, but my pee stream is not that forceful.
You're dehydrated.
No, I think it just, you know, how it's always shown. Like, whatever's around you kind of, like, comes up with you and floats alongside you. This time it's just, like... little bubbles of pee floating up with you and around you. I'll draw a picture of it later. Thank
you
for listening
to Broadcast from the Belfry. If you enjoyed what you heard today, if you learned something, please contact us at broadcastfromthebelfry@gmail.com or Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Drop us a line. We respond to everything. We don't have many hobbies. We love this. We love you guys.
I have a lot of hobbies. You speak for yourself.
I also do a lot of hobbies. We just love this one. And thank you to Marshall for making our intro. It makes us sound way more professional than we are. So we do have that in the link, or that link in the bio. If you would like to like follow him, give him some love. Also get some cool music. Maybe when you pee and are getting abducted, you want to have some cool music. Marshall could make that. You could have some cool alien pee abduction music. Yeah, once again, please send us your stories if you have anything spooky, creepy, or anything. Just let us know. We'll redact it. We'll change the name. We'll say your name more. Whatever you want. Buy some stickies if you want. We love stickers here. We have them. I think that's it. Do you have anything else you want to say, Georgia?
No.
All right. Well, what do we say to the children's sleep suit wearing listeners of this show?
Thanks for listening and stay spooky.
Naked sluts. You're not a slut because you're naked. Be naked if
you
want to.
How are you naked if you're wearing a sleep suit?
Damn. Yeah, you got me. Hey, Bill. I found you.